You're listening to a stage talk titled Researching Online Extremism and Terrorism. This week we're joined by Elizabeth Pearson, one of the authors of a recent report that presents findings from the field of digital research into extremism and terrorism. We talk about the harms that researchers in this field encounter during their work, and what we in the Bellingcat community can do to protect our mental and physical safety. You can find all of the links mentioned in the talk in the description of this podcast. The talk was hosted by me, Merel Soet, on Thursday the 10th of October in the Bellingcat Discord server.
All right, hi everyone. Thank you guys for joining us for this week's Bellingcat Discord stage talk. I am here today with Elizabeth Pearson. She works as a senior lecturer in criminology at the Royal Holloway University of London, where she leads the master's program in terrorism and counterterrorism studies. She's also active as an associate fellow with the International Center of Counterterrorism, as well as the Royal United Services Institute. Her research primarily focuses on gender, extremism, and counter-extremism. Together with her colleagues, she recently worked on the Reassure report, which is published with the online extremism and terrorism research network, Voxpol. The report describes experiences regarding safety and security of researchers who work on digital extremism and terrorism. Elizabeth and her colleagues talked to 39 online extremism and terrorism researchers, most of them focused on the online activity of far-right extremists and jihadists. The researchers they interviewed spoke about the range of harms they have experienced through their work, from intrusive thoughts, nightmares, and anxiety to online trolling and harassment. They also looked at the researchers' reliance on community networks to help them deal with these harms, as many of us here in the Discord community share an interest in these research topics. I'm looking forward to see what we can learn from their findings. All right, as we talk, please put your questions in the chat and I'll make sure to add them as we move into the Q&A section. And then now it's time to pass the mic to Elizabeth. Go ahead.
And thanks for inviting me to talk about the Reassure reports, which was, as you say, a report that came out last year that really looks at safety for researchers of online extremism and terrorism, but it has a lot of crossover lessons really for anyone who's engaged in sensitive or difficult work online. So this report was called the Online Extremism and Terrorism Researchers Security, Safety and Resilience Report, and Findings from the Field was the subtitle, because what we wanted to do, as you explained, was talk to researchers and find out, you know, what is this research doing to you? And not only that, but how can you help yourself not be harmed by it? Are you being harmed by it? And I should mention for anyone that is listening that if you are affected by anything that comes up, then do take care to get in touch perhaps afterwards or reach out for a copy of the report. I know it's been very helpful to people. And it's also sometimes quite difficult to hear me talking about other people's experiences where they might resonate with something you've experienced yourself that was harmful, but you haven't talked about it yet. So as Merel, you mentioned, the report really, you know, what we wanted to do was document clearly in researchers' own words as much as we could, the kinds of harms that they were experiencing as a direct result or that they connected to their research, which was specifically around online terrorism and extremism. And this was because there's been a really growing conversation in our field. Didn't exist to start with, you know, 20 years ago when people were doing internet research, there was no real awareness that looking at difficult things online might have any harmful effects or risks at all. So it was really a response to, you know, people have been doing this for a while and they've learned by really trial and error and making mistakes, I guess, that you can be harmed by doing this kind of work. But we also wanted to be positive and put some coping mechanisms in there and really increase that conversation and get institutions to talk about what's happening and to talk about their responsibilities towards researchers. Because one of the things that we found was, as you mentioned, it's communities, that's like networks of your friends, your colleagues, but it wasn't really the institutions themselves where researchers were working that were dealing with the problems that were coming up for researchers. And, you know, we thought that's a problem because those institutions should really be looking out for researchers. We're actually looking to expand the study at the moment. That's VoxPol, based at Swansea University. So look out, there's likely to be a survey out in the coming month, I think. So I guess I should start with maybe, you know, talking about the harms and the good news, which is that one of the things we found was that, you know, being harmed by doing this kind of work, difficult work, is not inevitable. So we talked to 39 researchers, as you mentioned. They were roughly split evenly between men and women, self-identifying as, and they were broadly at Western institutions and universities in the global north, with a couple of think tanks included as well. And we wanted to keep this fairly specific because people outside of the global north have different kinds of risks in terms of risks from the state, for instance. So we kept it to global north and Western institutions. So 30% did not have any significant harm, which is really good news. But bear in mind, this is kind of self-reported. So it might well be that people are being harmed, but just not aware of it yet. And that did come up when we were talking to people. We found a notable difference also between people who've been doing this kind of work for a long time. So senior scholars and younger or junior scholars, not always the same thing. The senior researchers were telling us, you know, we've spent quite a lot of years in this field, more than 10. We don't think we've experienced any harm. Whereas the junior researchers were saying, look, you know, we have experienced quite a lot of harm and it's had some impact on us. We don't know what was that was down to, but it could have been that this was a period in which some of the researchers we spoke to had been looking at Islamic State materials, and they were known for having a lot of visual materials, which are extremely difficult, high levels of brutality. And as Meryl, you mentioned, most of our researchers had either been working on jihadist material or the far right or both. And there are some differences there because jihadist material tended to be much more graphically violent than far right material. And that far right material was quite often text-based. No less difficult, no less harmful perhaps, but a different type of material in terms of the content. So we found that senior researchers were less likely to say that they had been harmed. And one of the key things that everybody told us, and I think was really important in protecting them from harms, was that, you know, they really were invested in their research because, you know, sounds a bit, you know, naive maybe, but because they wanted to make the world a better place. And that really helped to protect them, because if you believe in what you're doing, then that gives you a kind of, you know, that protects you, insulates you from some of the harms. You know, so some people did talk about the levels of violence, and they were, you know, really, you know, there's one person who had seen every single Islamic State video that has been produced. Now, he reported that he hadn't really had much harm, but, you know, but other people, these people, as they say, you know, I'm going to quote from someone here, you know, one person said to us, and this was a woman researcher, she was in her 50s, and she said, you know, I've watched so many people be executed on video. These people live in my head already. There's just some stuff and you can't unsee it, you know. And I think this is a refrain from some people who felt that they had been harmed, is that once you see something that is graphic, particularly violent, you know, you don't unsee it. So the trick is to make sure that you are only actively engaging with content that you need to see and that you want to see and that you are prepared to see, because that way it doesn't stay in your head so much. One of the other things that people reported to us was that, you know, when they were close to the material, it could be more harmful as well. So, for instance, if you are a Muslim researcher who absolutely did not believe in anything to do with jihad, you're opposed to it, but you're studying jihadism, then because it's close to you, in terms of your identity, that could be really morally injurious to you. It could create moral injury and more harm. Likewise, with researchers studying the far right or women who are researching misogynist manosphere groups, where you're close to it, or where they're, you know, the narratives are harmful to you specifically or your group of people, then that was something that could promote particular harm. And those harms came really in three forms. You know, there were the internal, psychological, kind of emotional harms. Then there were the harms to your physical security. Things like, you know, death threats, for instance. And then there were professional harms that came through, you know, the consequences of having these harms. I'm just going to talk a little bit more about that range of harms. So when we're talking about emotional harms, you know, these could creep up quite gradually. And some of them we could describe as post-traumatic stress disorder, although not everybody used psychological labels to describe these things. So they might talk about, you know, visual hallucinations, flashbacks, nightmares, anxiety, desensitization, hypervigilance, where you're waiting for something bad to happen, negativity, withdrawal, isolation. These were words that came up, but perhaps people weren't saying, oh, this is vicarious trauma related to, you know, someone else's trauma that I'm reading about or seeing on screen. Or they didn't use the term PTSD when perhaps they could have. Now, the people that did that because they had sought some psychological help. So that was quite interesting. But you know, a number of people had sought psychological help to deal with some of this. Then there was the security, the external harms, which includes doxing, personal details being spread across the internet, trolling, people following you, stalking you, harassing you online. That could last for days and be organized. Online abuse and pylons, abuse often gendered or racialized, threats to you, threats to your acquaintances, a possible attack on a home. We had one instance that the researcher was not sure was related to their work, but involved an arson attack on their home. And we had, in the worst possible case, a death threat to one of the researchers. It was a serious, credible death threat, which involved the relocation of family members, changes to routines, removal from social media, cancellation of public engagement meetings. So this was very serious and was something that they were helped through by both their employer and their research institute. They were working while they were doing a PhD. Now, 9 people experienced death threats of our cohort, but that was the only one that suggested this was credible. For a number of people, mainly getting death threats from jihadist actors, those actors were in a different country making those threats online, and the researchers did not perceive those to be credible, although they always reported them either to their line manager or supervisor where they were a student, because a lot of our cohort were also students, early career researchers. And you know, it to a certain extent had an effect simply to receive a death threat. Now, I think when it comes to those harms that relate to identity, to race, to gender, what people said was that, you know, they wanted to speak up, but often they didn't feel empowered to, you know, particularly if they were early career researchers. You know, one person said to us, and I'll read again, you know, having negative reactions to what you're encountering is not unusual, and researchers should not be afraid to speak up and seek help if necessary. Doesn't necessarily mean an end to their project. So it's about lowering the threshold for people speaking up. And, you know, that is clearly indicates to you that for some people, they felt nervous to speak up if they were being harmed. You know, why? Because there was a perception that, you know, if you were doing this kind of work, you needed to tough it out, you know, or if you showed any sign of a vulnerability, then that might be perceived as weakness. And people would try to shut you down as a researcher. They might feel that you're not personally suited to doing this kind of work. And what is really important in the report is that we say, you know, having the personality to do this kind of work is really a very tiny part of the story. Mainly, it's about resources being available to researchers to improve their resilience and to keep them safe. And those resources are nothing to do with personality or, you know, how strong you are as an individual. It's very much about surrounding structures, and those are largely institutional. And we found a huge variety in the kind of and quality of the support that researchers were getting, with some researchers getting, you know, virtually nothing and being very isolated, and other researchers, you know, being relatively well provided for with supervisors they felt they could trust, you know, conversations being brought up by senior staff, so it didn't put the responsibility onto them. And this was really important because, you know, I don't know if this affects those people listening, but, you know, academic researchers, you know, tend not to be anonymous. They're not like people that work for tech companies necessarily. They are, their names are out there. And also they're expected to do public engagement work, you know, doing a podcast like this, doing public meetings, talking about their research, because that's part of your job description. And actually, that's also your promotion criteria, getting out there, talking about what you're doing. So, you know, this is reliant really on your visibility. But if you're being trolled or you're being harmed, you might not feel like being visible. You might not want to put yourself out there and risk some of the pushback that you might face your research. And that resilience could be felt, that vulnerability, and that lack of resilience rather, could be felt quite strongly by those who are more precarious in this field. So those researchers of colour, women researchers, early career researchers, you know, who had the most really to gain from being out there invisible, but also had a lot to lose in terms of, you know, their confidence being really hit, or these negative experiences being quite formative around, you know, their future in this space. So those were the harms. So we talked to people too about how they coped, and what they told us really was that half of the people we spoke to, you know, they really didn't know what the risks might be before they started the work. So they weren't prepared. It kind of came as a shock to them, even though, you know, in the field, generally, there are people who have had experience. It wasn't necessarily shared. Some universities had a lot of researchers working on these really sensitive things, and others, they were maybe the only student or the only researcher working on this topic, and they just didn't have anyone to talk to. So that was really difficult. But as I stress, you know, coping mechanisms can be learned. It's not up to the individual on their own. So you need to have professional people around you showing you, telling you how to protect yourself. And one of those really important measures to protect yourself is to have some boundaries. Professional boundaries, work-life balance, shutting off from work, shutting down your laptop, switching off your mobile phone, not looking, although we're all, you know, on various pieces of social media all the time most. And when you're a researcher, you're looking at current news events, you're looking at, you know, the aftermath of a terrorist attack perhaps, or extremist groups. People became very loath to shut down because they were interested, they're engaged, they didn't want to miss something. And also they wanted to get those, you know, some people were trying to get data. So it became very hard, and they gradually, some people said to us, they recognized they simply weren't switching off, and that became very bad for their mental health. They were looking at things that were really sensitive and difficult and dangerous, you know, right before bedtime, dreaming about it, becoming desensitized and finding it hard. The key, talking, but, you know, you have to talk to the right people, because if you're spending a lot of your day watching extremely graphic, brutal videos, and then you go and talk to a general counselor or therapist and they ask you to describe some of this stuff, the worry is you're going to traumatize them. And this is so outside of the experience of ordinary people, thankfully, that, you know, you feel uncomfortable talking about it with them because it feels weird and it's unpleasant and you don't want them to be traumatized too. So finding the right people, people who really get what you're doing, was really important to this group of researchers. And some people had some quite quirky ways of making those professional boundaries. So we had a couple of people, one person who did put a lab coat on when they started doing their work, and one person who'd been told to put a lab coat on, hadn't started doing it yet. So it's just a kind of way of saying, right, I'm at work now. And, you know, particularly when for students, there might not be an office to go to. You might not have that kind of protected space to work in. The responsibility was often on the individual. And again, this is really something that ReAssure wants to kind of emphasize, is that no individual should really be responsible for protecting themselves in this space. It really should be about an institution too. So, you know, that's really, really important message from this report. And we found also that, you know, people were taking sometimes quite drastic measures. You know, someone in the States had, you know, practiced a shooting range, or one person had a knife, and they talked to us about this because they were worried about, you know, external threats. And they said, you know, look, you know, that they realized that this wasn't an everyday thing to do, but they felt like it was a world that they had become kind of, you know, part of, and that this was kind of troubling. And it's like the frog in the pot, isn't it, boiling? Like, and one person made that analogy that the frog only realizes that the water's boiling if, you know, right at the end you turn up that heat gradually. It's really hard to tell how bad things are getting. I would just finish the last kind of minute by saying, you know, as I've been saying all the way through, that institutions were really mixed, and for many, you know, online spaces weren't seen as a real space. Online connections weren't seen as real connections. Online research didn't count as real research. So the kinds of protections that you might get if you were, say, flying to Iraq or Syria to do research and meeting jihadists weren't necessarily there in all institutions, because online just wasn't recognized as a space where harm might occur, or a space per se. And I think, you know, that is also changing, because most of us are now connected pretty much all the time. So, you know, we found that communities were the key source of support, and we wanted more institutional support. And researchers, you know, were concerned about what was happening in the field, but we've had a lot of positive feedback since doing this study. And, you know, I can say, you know, from people that have come forward to say to me, thanks for raising this conversation. Thanks for reflecting some of the things that's happening. And we've been really pleased to see other studies taking place, you know, parallel to what we were doing, and to see people really expecting more of their institutions, and particularly those junior scholars, you know, really trying to demand good practice, and for this to be really built into that research so that it's budgeted for. And, you know, conversations are happening and are ongoing about what good practice should look like, what institutions should do to protect, whether you do force people to talk to a counsellor, or do you pay for it? You know, what are the approaches? And there are lots of different opinions on that. So I've been talking for 20 minutes, so I think I will stop here. And I'm sure that there'll be other things we can talk about relating to any questions people might have, or reflections that they have, or experiences that they want to share. And so thank you very much, Meryl.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. This is incredibly interesting and relevant, I think, for the work many of us are doing here in this server. And I also have seen that in the chat, people coming in with their own experiences. And please, everyone, put your questions in the chat. I've been getting some questions that ask for recommendations as people are experiencing these kind of harms themselves, maybe. Galore and Michael both asked what you would recommend for researchers at Bellingcat and our broader communities, people in the servers. And Galore specifically asked for what would you recommend for newcomers to protect ourselves against trauma that comes from doing this kind of work.
So there was some, I would recommend having a look at the report. I think you put a link to it in the chat, didn't you, Meryl? So I'd look at the report, but there are things that you can do. So I think one of the key things was that work-life boundary. So if you are in an analytic frame of mind, if you are have a key research question and you know what you need to see and what you don't need to see in order to answer that research question, then that is really helpful, because you're engaging analytically with your brain, with the material, and ensure that you only see what you need to see. So for instance, I have only seen, I think, you know, two execution videos in my life, I felt it was important to see one from each jihadist group that I was looking at, because I need to know what they do and who they are, but I don't need to see more than that, you know, and that's emotionally what I could cope with. You can minimize the effects by doing things to minimize the intensity of that exposure. So little tricks like putting your screen into black and white, minimizing visuals so that they don't fill the screen, switching sound down, fast forwarding through things that you don't need or want to see. And again, you know, being boundaried, not being taken by surprise, because this was where people experienced the most shocks, where they came across something that they just were not prepared for. So that preparation for doing that work is one thing. And, you know, debriefing with trusted friends and colleagues wherever you might find them, keeping those avenues of conversation open with the right people. Exploring, you know, getting therapy is not easy for everyone. It's not free for everyone. It can be expensive. Some institutions had quite good free well-being services. Others, even with free services, had huge long wait lists of like a year, which is no good really if you need it in the here and now. We actually found online was a very good support community. We know that scholars had been reaching out to one another online, and those connections were very meaningful. So that was important. And then regarding the external harms, you know, tricks which I'm sure people, no, not tricks really, but tools, you know, using a VPN, checking for personal data, ensuring that your video is blurred or that you have a fake background, or, you know, if you don't want to put your image on camera, feeling confident to say that. And sometimes it was a question of confidence. You know, we'd had more junior scholars say, look, you know, I did a media interview. Actually, without my permission, they used a photograph of me. I didn't realize they were going to do it. I didn't like to say afterwards, you know, I didn't like that because, you know, this is good exposure for my work, or I wasn't feeling confident. Or I went to an event and suddenly they said, it's going to be live streamed. Do you mind? Everyone else on the panel said, no, that's fine. That's great. But I have been trolled by the far right. So I didn't feel comfortable with that and didn't feel comfortable to say no because everyone else said it was fine. So it was a question of confidence and knowing that it's okay to make those assertions. And importantly, in a culture where sometimes there can be some machismo, there can be a bit of bravado around, you know, this, in a sense, the same kind of norms around that violence is cool, violence is good in some way, the same kinds of norms as those extreme actors putting that stuff out there. You know, violence is not good. Violence is not cool. Watching violence does not make you a better researcher than someone who doesn't watch violence. There is no weakness in saying, I don't want to see another human being harmed in a video. That's not weak. You can study terrorist or extreme groups without exposing yourself to harm. That is possible. So there's no weakness in coming forward. And you know, it's easier said than done, but challenging those people who might, you know, insist on you as a junior scholar engaging with some of this stuff. So I'll finish there, but there's more in the report itself.
Thank you. There's some really good points. Very important to get that conversation started also here. And that's a question I had myself, actually, because how can a community network like ours play a role in mitigating these harms and facilitate a conversation around these topics?
Well, I think just, you know, having this conversation is quite important because it shows that you value people's safety in this space and that you recognize that there is a potential risk. And I think just that recognition is actually a relatively new thing, you know, probably only the past 5 years. And I would credit, you know, Charlie Winter, who was previously with ICSR, did a lot of work on Islamic State narratives and videos and, you know, was, I think, quite bold in sort of talking about this to journalists and saying, you know, this is a feature that, you know, and I think, you know, he'd said quite publicly he would be with one of his children and, you know, and having dinner and then the next second looking on his phone at Islamic State material and this kind of juxtaposition of this weird, like, lack of work-life boundaries causing this two kind of totally opposite worlds could be weird and harmful. So having the conversation is a really great first step, encouraging people to talk to one another. And I think, you know, making it clear that institutions bear some responsibility here. The work doesn't all need to be done by the researcher. And be aware that your colleagues who are more isolated, not in a team of people, scholars of colour, scholars who are women, scholars who are in a minority group working on extremism that affects them, you know, these are often the people that are pushing that field forward. You know, trans community, for instance, working on transphobia, you know, people need to be safe to do the work to push the field forward and to really, you know, open up the field to new ideas and new research. So pushing that awareness that institutions have a responsibility, they can't just make it, put that onus and the burden on the researcher, I think is hugely important. And challenging, as again, I hope this conversation is doing, challenging the idea that talking or being harmed is a weakness that means you're not fit to do this kind of work. Because I don't think in the case of our research that that's true. And some of the people who talked about perhaps, you know, some of the more severe harms were some of the people who've been doing phenomenally good work and for some time. And I would also say that some people had had experience of mental health issues prior to starting the work, but that didn't make them more vulnerable. I think it gave them good resilience, actually, because they're already used to talking about their problems. They already knew their own vulnerabilities and weaknesses. They already, you know, were used to talking because they'd perhaps engaged with a psychologist or a therapist in the past. So they were actually quite well equipped in this space, which, you know, might perhaps surprise some people who think, you know, having a previous mental health issue might make you less suited to this work. It wasn't really borne out in the research.
Thank you. We have lots of questions coming in, so please keep them coming. And I want to continue with a question that is maybe a bit outside of the scope of research, but something that researchers probably also experience, as he states that when he opens his Twitter in the morning, it's like being caught off guard from it. A violent video can come up. It feels like a train going out of the rail. Such an unexpected video, and it often impacts me more than when I'm investigating or searching it myself, which means that I'm more prepared for it. What would you suggest in these kind of scenarios?
And I think, you know, that exactly echoes what people said to us. And I think, you know, I feel the same. And I look at X and it's pretty much the first thing I do sometimes in the morning, which is, I think it's not good for me. I recognize that. And yet I still do it because I'm not in control of anyone could have posted anything. And, you know, I am exposed to it without my being ready for it, aware of it. And I have also been taken off guard in that way. Now, for myself, I would say there's no fast rules here. You have to make your own rules for what works for you. And for every person, there might be something slightly different. But, you know, for me, it's the person who's asked the question or made that comment just said, it's about, you know, not being in that analytic space. So if you feel that that is happening more and more frequently because there's less and less moderation of content on X and more inappropriate or harmful things are getting through, and I would prepare yourself mentally before you go on. Don't just idly flick, as I think we can all do, idly, you know, browse through social media, go from platform to platform, just kind of like scrolling through. It can be like with X, standing in the middle of a superhighway of just, you know, information whizzing past you, and some of it is quite unpleasant, quite harmful potentially. So I think in that question, in that comment came, I think, the answer there, which is about, you know, accessing these spaces, which may have been in the past different and less harmful, recognizing that they are becoming more harmful and accessing them in a more boundaried way. I think, unfortunately, you know, X has changed, platforms change over time. So, you know, recognizing their dynamic as well and what worked in the past might not work anymore.
Moving out to the next question, Foxton is asking how can we also work to break down barriers or stigma around trauma in analysts and researchers? It's often only those that who have seen direct action who tend to be taken seriously in mainstream discussions when it comes to the violence subject matter.
I think you're right. I think that there is a sort of, or at least there has been in the past, perhaps a hierarchy of, you know, if you were there, then that counts as trauma. And if you weren't, then, you know, what are you complaining about? You saw a video of something. What does that mean? But I think that is becoming quite an outdated view, actually, I'm glad to say. And if you look at other spaces, if you look at charities, if you look at journalism, for instance, you know, so much journalism is about sifting through video material to try and find something to put on air. And, you know, journalists have recognized for some years now that vicarious trauma is real and it is serious. And it is not the kind of, it's not the poor cousin of trauma from being somewhere. It's still trauma. And just because it was mediated through video or through audio does not mean it cannot be harmful. So that conversation has been happening in other fields. And if you look to journalism, there are plenty of reports. And that is because journalism and indeed tech companies have had to be taking this seriously. If you look at, you know, organizations like Meta, Facebook, they have been dealing with lawsuits because moderators have said, look, you know, we've been exposed to quite a lot of harmful content. And it's content, but it's no less harmful for that. And once you get, you know, litigation, you get things to be taken seriously. So in these, you know, more corporate worlds of tech companies and journalistic companies, you see these things being taken seriously. And I think in academic research, we've been perhaps a little bit behind about recognizing that video material, however you view it, and a lot of it clearly is online, it can cause trauma. And that trauma is part and parcel of watching brutal, difficult material. It's not the sort of poor cousin, as I said, of being in the field. It's a real phenomenon that is taken seriously by many other organizations and deserves to be taken seriously within research institutions and academia equally. And I think, you know, the fact we had some very senior researchers talking to us, taking this seriously and sort of saying, you know, I'm really glad that you are looking at this because it's been on my mind, really want to make sure that my students are protected, whether they'd experienced harms themselves or not. You know, we know that in tech companies that there are, you know, officers generally engaged with the protection, the safety of their employees. We know that some tech companies are mandating, you know, work chat. You don't have to go and talk to the counsellor, but they're there. It destigmatizes it. It's not like you have to ask to go and talk to someone. It's just there for you. So this is absolutely an important source of potential harm. And I think that conversation is changing thanks to, you know, progress made ahead of time in other fields.
Thank you. And you already mentioned a bit, but you also had a variety of researchers, variety in age. And Galore is asking a question about the younger researchers and whether you think that it makes a difference. Because he's sharing a personal story about how he finds himself being desensitized now graphic materials such as Islamic State material is so exposed on the internet. It's so easy to find, even though it still bothers him. Do you think it makes a difference in the extent to which you can be harmed by this research, growing up with this amount of violent and graphic content on the internet?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that it was the younger ones that said they were more harmed when perhaps they'd been more exposed generally. And this idea of desensitization is also, you know, it's also interesting because one of the things that we found was that, you know, people used various different coping mechanisms in addition to the ones I mentioned when I was talking earlier. So humor, for instance, was one, joking about things. But, you know, perhaps people recognized there was positive coping mechanisms and there were less positive, less healthy coping mechanisms too, that maybe humor was not such a positive coping mechanism. It was something you could share with your colleagues, but what did it say? You know, people didn't want to be desensitized to extreme violence or to very harmful narratives. They wanted to remain shocked and to be aware that this stuff is shocking. And yet, of course, if you're engaging with this as part of your job, then inevitably the shock factor is reduced because it's becoming your everyday. There's a colleague of mine, a researcher called Olivier Cobergs, who was formerly in the police in Belgium, I think, and he'd done some work on what constituted a sort of maximum amount of hours before you would start getting harmed. And it was 10 hours of exposure a week, essentially. So that's kind of in a working day, 2 hours. And we talked to some researchers that were working, you know, manically working, getting a project finished, and were, you know, looking at 12 hours of material a day for weeks on end. You know, poor working practices were, you know, contributing to this pressure from seniors to get something finished, you know, and we'll deal with the consequences afterwards. So, you know, this issue of desensitization, it's problematic because it also, it stops you, it's like your nerves have been, you know, cauterized. You can't tell anymore whether you're being harmed long term or not. And that's another thing that Charlie Winter has kind of raised, that researcher I mentioned working on Islamic State, was that, you know, long term, you know, really long term, 20 years down the line, I don't really know what the effects are. Because, you know, we talked to some senior researchers who've been, you know, some of them had been researching this since the beginnings of the internet, you know, when it was all like closed fora before internet 2.0. And it, you know, they were the people that were saying we're not harmed. So maybe, you know, who knows whether a long-term consequence is this idea of they're so desensitized that they're not even aware of the harm. Or maybe they just grew up in an age where that those harms, that material was less brutal, less graphic, and that somehow protected them. You know, that was difficult. We couldn't know either way what that reason for their perception was. But sure, I think desensitization is a coping mechanism and it's a problem.
Thank you. Please, everyone, if you want to ask your questions, we are running into the last 15 minutes of the 20 minutes of the conversation. So please put them in the chat before we round off. I have a question from Tintin that's asking, in an increasingly polarized and surveyed digital environment, how do individuals balance the need for self-censorship to protect personal safety with the responsibility to contribute to open and meaningful public discourse?
You know, it's a good question. And I think, you know, I do agree that researchers do have a responsibility to try to be open, to disseminate their work, but not at the risk of their own mental health or their own safety. So I think it's about planning. It's about, you know, telling, you know, sharing with your colleagues in your department. You know, even your colleagues, you know, close colleagues sometimes might not, they might be working on something slightly different. Or, you know, in a university, there might be a marketing department which has got absolutely no idea that you've been trolled or you have the potential to be trolled, for instance. And this, you know, I'm reminded of a story that, again, someone told us for the report that, you know, their marketing team in the university, you know, wanted, had used a big picture of their face with something. This was a woman, younger woman researcher. And they weren't asked because it had never occurred to the marketing team that it might be a problem. You know, they just didn't know. So it's about educating those people around you who might not be aware of some of the risks, so that they can be prepared. They never put you inadvertently in, you know, at risk of trauma or harm. And it's about, you know, limiting yourself. And one of the most difficult things that we saw was that people, once they'd been trolled or harmed, they tended to self-censor. They didn't want to put themselves out there. You know, and we had one woman who said to us, you know, she was working on the Manosphere and she had a terrible meme produced featuring her, you know, face and with all kinds of unpleasant, you know, sexualized remarks about her. And when she told a couple of her colleagues, they basically, you know, kind of victim blaming her and said, look, well, you know, what were you doing? And you shouldn't have been, you shouldn't have been engaging with them online, and if it was part of her research, and you know, you need to keep a low profile for a while. And so she didn't have any support in any other option but to silence herself. So, you know, that was really problematic, that, you know, essentially she was shut down by the experience, not just of being trolled, but by the advice of her colleagues who didn't recognise that it wasn't her fault. She just deserved a bit more protection, and that perhaps they needed a team to talk about the risks that some of them were facing and how to mitigate that. So it is a balancing act. You know, as I say, some people never experienced any harms at all or anything that they perceived as harmful. And, you know, they didn't feel, they felt they'd been lucky in that. Whereas some people had had a couple of bad experiences because they were, you know, working with, you know, dicey subjects that where people were, you know, keeping an eye out for their work and, you know, organising pylons. So had some really different experiences of how to manage that. But the most important thing is that you don't never feel pressured into doing something, I think, as an individual that you don't feel happy or comfortable with. Because at the end of the day, you know, your safety and your mental health are paramount. And it's really incumbent upon institutions and colleagues to support you in the decisions that you're making and to try and help you to propagate your research in ways that are not going to be harmful to you and that enable you to get the career benefits of your work. Sorry, it's a very wishy-washy answer, I feel. But it's not an easy question.
It's definitely not an easy question. And that I think your answer was great. It's also, I like that we get to have this conversation with the community because I see a lot of response on your comments as well. And I see some more questions coming in. Foxton is asking, what are ways that we as a community can also help to spread good media sanitation practices to the broader public? I am disheartened to see many well-meaning and passionate people who want to be engaged in activism, however, undoubtedly subject themselves to traumatic content, almost as a means of, as a cognitive self-flagellation. Wow. So the question in here is, what are the ways that we as a community can help to spread this idea of good media sanitation practices to the audience outside of our communities?
So around cultures, I mean, I think it's being open, you know, being open to listening. It's about listening as much as talking. And that was really key from what came back from, you know, people saying to us, I talk to the community of people who get it, people who understand, because I don't want to traumatize other people and those people don't understand. I can't talk openly with them. So, yes, talk where you need to talk, but listen to your friends and colleagues where you need to listen. And, you know, let's not victim blame. Let's not shame people. And let's try and collectively work together to change institutional norms around this. And that can be really hard, but if the online cultures shift, you know, as I think they had done, which is what led to a conversation between myself, colleagues from Swansea Uni, Dublin City University, Voxpol, the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, Hadaya, you know, we all recognised, and we're not all in the same country, not all doing the same thing, that there is a culture change, a shift in people beginning to talk about harms and recognising it's not shameful. It's not hard or clever to like look at extreme content and brag about it. So contributing to that shift by talking without shame and listening without shaming, I think is really key. And I see that happening, you know, more and more. And that has to be a good thing.
Right. I have a question by Liz, which states that it's a controversial question. They elaborate on their ideas about the differentiation between words and harm. I think that the rhetoric around words as harm in arguments actually leads to people being harmed by words. They think we should differentiate between physical bodily harm and arguments. Could we have a healthier culture surrounding arguments surrounding argument by seeing words as words and trolling and physical violence as harm?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. What is violence? And, you know, I do like gender work in my work on extremism. Not all of it is online, a lot offline also. And this question of what is violence is kind of a really big feminist question too, because, you know, violence is often mostly understood as physical violence, you know, those external security threats. Whereas, you know, a lot of feminist scholars would say violence has a variety of different forms, and, you know, words can create violence. They can constitute violence in themselves. I mean, I don't know if, like, you know, most of the researchers that we talked to didn't necessarily talk about, they didn't use the word violence at all, actually. But what they described when they read harmful rhetoric, so for instance, far right propaganda, they said it was harmful, but maybe in slightly different ways. So maybe it wore them down, being constantly exposed to particular discourses, rhetoric and propaganda. I think, you know, just to talk to people about the emotional effects of words, seems to me that there are harmful effects. They're not created by, you know, framing words as harm, because often people have been taught, you know, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me, you know, as a kind of motto. And yet still they find themselves emotionally harmed and made more fragile, more vulnerable through words, you know. And it can, as I say, lead to censorship, self-censorship, and a lack of visibility. You know, a death threat that is received is just words, but it can have at the worst case, it could have a fatal outcome. So that's words, but, you know, needs to be taken seriously. So, you know, I'm kind of, you know, I'm in the UK, we have different ideas about free speech, I guess, in the UK. And I know that this ties into, you know, questions and conversations, debates around the limits of free speech, what kinds of speech should be censored and why, and, you know, fears that, you know, limitations on particular words and speech will create a kind of, you know, undue sensitivity to things to which we should be more hardened. But I don't think it's that simple. And I, you know, the experience of talking to researchers about the types of harms they experienced shows that words trolling can be harmful, just as words online can be amazing. You can really feel things through being online, whether that's, you know, excitement, collegiality, joy, love. Look at the people who are, you know, scammed by online people who they form real relationships with. So online words matter. They create real emotions. And, you know, therefore, I think they can create real harms as well as real joy. Everything is out there online. So, you know, but I appreciate the question. It is an interesting debate, definitely.
Thank you. We're really running into the last minutes of the talk. So if you have a question, put them up now. We have a question of someone who's asking, do you find that there's a gender imbalance in who is doing the victim blaming? And do you think victim blaming is often really sloppy, bad, OPSEC, operational security, gastricizing?
Did we see a gender imbalance? You know, I talked about a macho culture, but it wasn't necessarily always. You know, actually, I don't think we actually accounted for that in the report. And to be honest with you, anecdotally, I can think of a couple of things that people said in their interviews with us that related to either sex of the people that they worked with. So we had a case of a female supervisor basically saying, if you want to work on a project with this, then you've got to look at the material. You know, I'm not going to accept any sort of excuses about not looking at this material. And then we've had, you know, people refer to a culture in which there were both men and women, you know, bantering, again, this kind of machismo around it. So, I mean, that culture is gendered, but I would say that from what people told us for the report, it wasn't one gender that was kind of propagating that culture. It was something which everybody potentially could be part of. So yeah, that's an interesting question.
And to round off and start looking ahead a bit, are there any emerging trends in online extremism and the field you're researching that you believe researchers should be aware of?
I mean, this field is evolving all the time. And there are times when one particular area of research is particularly topical and where those researchers are perhaps at more risk. You know, if you think of 2015, 2016, when Islamic State was all over, you know, Twitter for a while and was then, it was, in the words of, I think, UK government, the Wild West online. And those researchers were hot property. Everyone wanted to talk to them and they were put under pressure perhaps to take risks that they were not taking otherwise. You know, now there are perhaps, Islamic State is still around, obviously, but there are perhaps other topics that people are looking at. I mean, there is so much extremism out there of any ideology in all regions, all languages. You know, whether we're looking at extremism related to the Hamas incursion into Israel a year ago and Israel's response to that, or what's happening in Russia and Ukraine. You know, where there is conflict and violence, there will be researchers trying to understand that. And, you know, this field is evolving. And therefore, I think we should be open to the risks evolving too, and to be prepared to come across new things and to be willing and open to discuss those as they come up. You know, that's the beauty of the internet and online, is that it's a dynamic space. But, you know, that raises new problems. So this report hopefully will be useful, but maybe in 5 years' time, some of it will be out of date and there'll be a space for someone else to do some, you know, research. I'm sure there are more people doing research in this area and coming up with some good ideas to protect people.
No. Thank you very much. And I think we're rounding off here as we're it's almost six. I want to thank you. I think it's great to have this conversation in the Discord server we have here at Bellingcat. It's very relevant, and I hope we can also keep this conversation up. Bellingcat has resources. I will share them in the description of the podcast as well as in the chat about mental health, mental hygiene as a researcher. And I want to thank you very much for your insights. I hope people thought it was interesting and have gained some insights. We'll read the report. And thank you, everyone, for your questions. I'm going to end the recording here. And as always, the recording will be on your favorite streaming platforms in the coming days. And in 2 weeks, we'll be back with a new episode. Thank you very much.
And thanks for everyone for coming along. It's been brilliant. Really great questions. I just hope it's helped a bit. Keep safe.
Thank you for listening to the Stage Talk. If you'd like to catch a Stage Talk live where you can ask the guest questions, join the Bellingcat Discord server by visiting www.discord.gg/Bellingcat. The music you've heard is titled Dawn by Newer Self and is courtesy of Artlist.